So he's likely killed before, and he doesn't feel the slightest remorse. And the similarity between the two attacks shows we're looking at the same trigger. The nature of the attack also shows we're looking for a loner, an asocial type, someone who's withdrawn and unsure of himself, though he hides it well, and he's not necessarily antisocial.
Aren't antisocial and asocial the same thing? Said the skinny ass who'd sleezed on Frost earlier.
Not quite. Asocial people are introverts. They prefer to spend time alone, but can socialise well if they need to. Antisocial people have no empathy for others and are hostile towards society. It's actually a form of personality disorder.
I noted the confused faces.
Put it like this, an asocial person might say, I'd rather not go to that party. An antisocial one would say, I'm going to ruin it.
I didn't add that I fitted into the first category, or that the second type have often found themselves on the wrong side of my weapon.
I've mentioned before that the offender's an emasculated male. In addition to that, he's possibly experiencing what psychiatrists call decompensation. In other words, his usual coping mechanisms aren't working, causing him to spiral out of control. And we know from what he did to his victims that control is important to him. The reason for this is he's not managing in other aspects of his life. Most specifically, sexually.
Like you, eh, Billy boy? Said Ruddock to the pretty Ricky sitting next to him.
Dick wipe.
You said this morning he was attached, said Isaacson, shooting Ruddock a warning look. Do you still think that?
Aye, either married or living with a partner. But it's not a happy relationship. The female emasculates him, though she may not realise it. These attacks are about regaining control and punishing her for his inadequacies. The women he preys on are surrogates. They have a similar look, and that tells us they physically resemble his true target. At the moment, he's content to take his rage out on stand-ins, but at some point he'll build up the confidence to attack her directly. We need to use the media to appeal for information. If I'm right about the offender having a partner, she'll have noticed something. The killer will have come home after the homicides with blood on his clothes. On top of that, he'll have exhibited signs of post-kill exhaustion, which will make him behave erratically. There's no way his partner wouldn't have noticed a change in his behaviour. She may even have suspicions about him. We need to find her. Not only is she our best hope of catching him, she might also be his ultimate victim.
Chapter 28. I'm half worried about jinxing things by writing this, but I think I'll explode if I don't get it out. The lead curtain has finally lifted. My husband loves me again. Blue Eyes is back. I've been so lonesome I could almost cry with relief. Yesterday, he came home with a present for me. A heart on a chain from Tiffany. A symbol of our love, he said. Two people meant to be together forever. You and me against the world. Then he kissed me properly like we were lovers and told me I was beautiful, even though I've put on 3 pounds since last week and was wearing my old sweatpants. I felt the tears swell up in my throat. He forgives me, I thought, and he loves me. He wanted to have sex after that, but I couldn't, and I was so worried he was going to get pissed with me. But he didn't. He was just so nice and understanding, and of course that made me feel 10 times worse. I wish I could just enjoy the way things are, but I keep on thinking, where's the catch? This is too good to be true. And then the next minute, I'm getting angry with myself for letting my insecurity ruin things. All I know is I just cannot go back to the way things were. Whatever I do, I can't let that happen. Which is why I think I'm going to do what he asked me. Just a little favor, he said. And it probably won't happen anyway, but if the police speak to you, say I was home at midnight on Tuesday. The thing is, I don't know if he was. Tuesdays when I had that blackout, and when I came round it was well after 2 a.m. But that doesn't mean anything, I suppose. And like I said, I am not going to screw this up now he loves me again.
Chapter 29. Scotland Yard, 1905. I left Isaacson setting up a press conference for the next morning, then looked up the number for Bodie Calder, the waste of space running Duncan's homicide investigation. He picked up the phone after several rings, probably on his way out.
It's Ziba McKenzie. I'm in the building. Do you have time for a quick chat?
Sure. He didn't sound too excited about it.
Great, I'll be right down.
When Duncan was killed, Calder had promised me he'd hunt down his killer and make him pay. It was a cheese dick line, but I'd bought it. He had a reputation for getting results. And as Duncan would have said, they'll be twisting all the knobs. This was one of their own, after all. But 2 years had gone by without so much as a hint of an arrest, let alone a suspect, and I was losing faith in him. I'd tried to help from the off, but Calder had pushed me away.
You're too personally invested. You need to trust me to do my job, he'd said.
The way I saw it, I'd held up my end of the deal, but he hadn't delivered on his. It was time for him to stop screwing the damn donkey and start getting results. And Duncan's flash drive might be just the fuel injection he needed. Jack had been right about me not marching into HQ, running my mouth off about sunlight, but I couldn't keep the intel from Calder, not if it finally helped steer him along the right tracks. I knocked on his door and went in.
Good to see you, Mac, he said, coming over.
I took half a step back. Someone should really introduce the guy to deodorant, I thought, as a waft of ripe fumes assaulted my airways. He stuck out his hand. He was wearing an entry-level Rolex. Not as pricey as Axel Montan's, but worth a few grand at least. A recent acquisition too, judging by the pristine bracelet. But how had someone on a DI's salary been able to afford it? Nice watch. Robbed a bank, have you? I was only joking around, but he tensed visibly. I'd obviously touched a nerve. He wasn't proud of whatever he'd done to get his windfall then. Calder and Johnny W. have a special relationship. Maybe he'd spiced up the mix with a little gambling. Booze and ponies always were a popular combo.
So what brings you to the Kremlin, he said, or are you just here about my finances?
No, not working with HMRC just yet. Vulcan called me in, asked me to help out on this serial killer case.
The gynecologist?
That's disgusting, he laughed.
Afraid I can't claim the credit.
Not sure credit is the word I'd use. He shrugged and walked over to his desk.
Have a drink with me?
He said, pulling a near-empty bottle of Red Label out of his bottom drawer. No, you're all right, I won't stay long. Just wanted to know if there have been any developments on Dunk's case.
You'll be the first to know if there are.
He unscrewed the lid and poured out a 3-inch measure. I'm sure it's linked to something he was working on. You've spoken to his old team, right?
Nothing's come of that, he said, taking a slug of scotch.
I narrowed my eyes. He was lying. But why?
We're working on a gang-shooting theory at the moment.
You can't be serious. This was a single execution shot. Clean and professional. Gangs don't operate like that. I paused. I have to tell him, I thought. I always prefer to work alone. The way I see it, if you don't trust other people, you can't be let down. But you can't fight an army single-handed. I found something, I said. A flash drive of Duncan's. He'd hidden it behind a fake plug socket in our flat. It was last saved 2 days before he was killed. I think he was looking into irregularities connected to an operation codenamed Sunlight, and judging by a conversation I overheard today, I think it may still be active. You should look into it.
Calder stroked his fancy new watch. He'd gone very pale. All peely-wally, Duncan would have said.
Did you make copies?
Strange question.
No, but I...
I'll need the stick as soon as possible.
His toes were pointing towards the door, his body's way of showing he wanted me to leave.
Roger that, I'll get it to you first thing tomorrow.
No, it's better if I have it before then. Where's the flash drive now?
Safe, I said. There was a limit to what he needed to know.
Where?
My instincts kicked in. Why does it matter?
Maybe we could go and get it together.
What's with the damn hurry, I thought, and why is he being so insistent? I looked him over. The clenched jaw, the muscle jumping in his cheek. Suddenly, I had the feeling Bodie Calder and I weren't on the same team at all.
Chapter 30. I'm crawling out of my skin. I don't know what to do. I think I've done a very bad thing and I don't know how to put it straight. My husband was right. The police did want to speak to me, and I told them exactly what he asked me to. He was so sweet, phoning afterwards to see how I was and how it had all gone. Taking my calls, even when he was busy, and I know he doesn't like to be disturbed. I love you so much, he said. We're meant to be together, you and me. It made me so happy to hear him talk that way, like I was made of air. How could I have thought of not helping him, especially given everything he's done for me?
I make more than enough to provide for us both, he said when yet another art gallery rejection letter had come through all those years ago.
8 months out of college, and I still had no frigging job.
There is no need for you to work, he said, stroking my back, soothing.
Stay at home. It'll be better for you.
Gee, remembering that makes me feel even more guilty for doubting him. But now the thought's in my head, I just can't shoo it away. The thing is, he's obsessed with that serial killer business that's on the news the whole time. The Hillside Slasher. He's always watching stuff about it on TV, and the other day I found all these newspaper cuttings hidden in the drawer by his side of the bed with bits highlighted in yellow pen. Plus one of the bodies was found outside his kickboxing gym. And of course he does have a link to the victims. But what's really getting to me is this. He needed me to give him an alibi for midnight on Tuesday. Except I can't be sure he was home then. And that's the exact time they're saying the first girl was killed.
Chapter 31. Scotland Yard, 1925. I was on my way out of the building, processing the bizarre exchange with Calder, when my mobile rang. I didn't recognize the number and the name wasn't in my contacts list.
Ziba McKenzie speaking.
Hello, this is Dan Harper, from Scotland Monton. We spoke earlier. I hope it's okay me calling, only you did say to ring if I thought of anything and... Well, there is something, actually.
His words were coming out like machine gun fire. The guy was out of breath, all over the place. Nervous, obviously. My blood danced. Nervous usually equals news. The big kind. Slow down, Dan. Start at the beginning. What is it you want to tell me?
The thing is, I saw Lily in the bar last night. She was talking to a guy in the corner, kind of close, you know? And then not long after she left. I saw him leave too.
Really? Why had no one else mentioned this? Are you sure that's what you saw? Nobody else said anything.
Well, it was dark in there,
said Dan, talking even faster than before, gabbling like he had when we'd first met.
And like I told you, they were in a corner. There were loads of us at the bar. I mean, it's not that surprising that no one else saw, right?
He'd certainly thought it through. Can you describe the man she was with?
I'm not sure. He might have had a beard. It was dark. Sorry, I didn't mean to waste your time. I just thought you should know.
You did the right thing. Thank you. It was only after I hung up that I wondered why it had taken all day for him to come forward.
Everyone's weird apart from you and me, and even you're a little bit weird, Duncan would have said.
An old saying he spouted a lot. It made him laugh each time he did. Little things please little minds, I'd tell him.
Maybe that's why I like you so much, eh?
Damn it, Duncan. I wish I could quit thinking about you, I thought, exiting the building.
Walking along the Broadway, I texted Isaacson about my call with Harper and was just putting the phone back in my pocket, musing about what it could mean, when an SMS came through from Jack.
Should be with you in an hour.
It was a magic bullet. Now all I could think of was telling him about Calder and Watkiss and how I felt about seeing him. Chapter 32. Bloomfield Villas, London, 2040. The doorbell rang. Jack. My stomach flipped. I was right back to that moment in his car. Go make yourself a cup of suck-it-the-fuck-up tea, Mackenzie. I checked the mirror without thinking. For crap's sake!
Hey, Wolfie.
His head nearly reached the top of the frame. My flat suddenly seemed a whole lot smaller with him in it. Little and large, Duncan used to call us.
Good to see you, Mac,
he said, bending down for a one-arm hug. He looked good, though his hair was as messy as always. I swear he never brushes it. Smells amazing. I nodded at the carrier bag he was holding. You got seaweed?
Of course, he grinned. And no, I didn't forget the spring rolls or the crispy duck.
I'm famished, I said, as we unpacked the cartons onto my dining table and I opened a bottle of Gewürz. I haven't eaten since breakfast.
Hillside slasher case keeping you busy,
he said, a little too nonchalantly, using his shirt tails to wipe the rain off his glasses. I don't see him in them that often. He mainly wears them when he's working, says staring at the computer screen dries out his lenses. You're so unsubtle, and before you ask, I can't tell you anything. There's a press conference tomorrow. You'll hear all the gruesome details then. Though I will say this, there's something up with the SIO, and not just that the guy never cracks a smile.
Who is it?
Bloke called Isaacson.
Donald Isaacson.
Aye, that's right. Do you know him?
Only that he doesn't like my sort too much. Got stick recently for not holding media conferences or giving out enough information over that double homicide, you know, the one a few months back.
Doesn't surprise me. I smeared plum sauce on a pancake, padding it out with shredded duck and cucumber slices. The guy's got trust issues. He isn't best pleased to have me foisted on him, that's for sure. Nor's the rest of the team, for that matter.
Been making friends, have you?
I think some of them have forgotten victims are real people.
And you've taken it upon yourself to remind them?
I laughed. Someone has to.
Scotland Yard has confirmed that the killer responsible for the murder of young mother Yasmin Pejman last week has struck again in Primrose Hill, home to celebrity icons like Kate Moss and Jude Law. Lily Abian's body was discovered.
I switched the radio off. I'd had enough media hype for one day.
You're usually the one banging on about keeping a personal distance from victims, Jack said, mopping up sweet chili sauce with his spring roll. What's changed?
I don't know.
Yes, you do. Is it about Duncan?
Maybe. I swirled the wine round my glass, staring at the teary tracks easing down the sides of the glass. It's not just him, though. There's something about the victims. They're Iranian, you know? Looked like me, too, and... He eyeballed me.
You frightened?
Don't be stupid, I said, though I knew what he meant. I've attracted the attention of a serial killer before.
The London Lacerator. It didn't end well. Jack dug his chopsticks into a carton of deep-fried noodles. He'd brought a feast.
Just be careful, he said, and for God's sake, if you're worried about anything, report it to Isaacson. You know what happened last time.
All right, thanks. Enough with the lecture. Do you want to hear my news or not?
What news?
He said, mouth full. I ran into someone today.
Oh, yeah?
Watkiss. One of the names from Duncan's file. I looked him up on the system afterwards. He's a vice DI, did time in the Dirty Squad, the Obscene Publications Unit. He's working off-street prostitution now.
Shit, you don't hang around.
I smiled. There's more. When I saw Watkiss, he was talking to another guy. I checked him out too, name's Rex Lutim, some civil servant.
That's not so unusual, is it? You often find Whitehall types at Scotland Yard.
True, but why were they talking about sunlight?
Sunlight,
he said, eyes wide. I nodded. He rubbed at the scar on his cheekbone, an injury from his school days. Jack and his brothers had moved around a lot. He wasn't as big back then, and being the new kid in class has its disadvantages.
Doesn't make sense, he said. Sunlight's been shut down. So why were they talking about it?
Especially when it's been dead for 2 years. Chapter 33. I took another slug of wine before bringing Wolfie up to speed on my confab with Calder. The next bit of news. I'm telling you, something was way off with B.O., I said, after I'd given him the sit rep. And not just that he stinks for England. Jack's usually quick to tell me I'm being paranoid, and I was all ready for him to say I was getting worked up over nothing now. So his reaction took me by surprise, and if anything, raised the threat rating on my initial suspicions.
I wish you hadn't told him about the flash drive.
I made a call, though I accept it might have been the wrong one. Jack rubbed his chin between his fingers and thumb. It made a scratchy sound. He had more than a 5 o'clock shadow going on. But then again, he's never gone for the clean-cut look. Duncan was the same way, only his stubble was sprinkled with grey.
Question is, where do we take it from here? He said.
Well, for starters, he can forget about getting his hands on the flash drive. That's not going to happen. I stuck my nose in my wine glass and took a deep sniff. Flora and the warm south, I thought, remembering that line from Ode to a Nightingale. Duncan was mad about Keats. He had a thing for the romantics, Byron especially. We had a heated discussion not long before he was killed about a letter Byron wrote where he said pain gives life meaning. I argued that to experience happiness, you have to open yourself up to the possibility of getting hurt. I was pretty definite about it at the time, but after Duncan was shot, I U-turned. Nothing was worth what his death made me feel. It had seemed less strange, Calder getting all worked up like that, if he'd ever shown the slightest interest in anything I had to say about Dunk's murder, I said now. This is the first time I've ever seen him worked up about anything.
And as for that gang shit, I mean, what's he thinking?
Aye, well, I raised the bullshit flag pretty quickly on that one.
I don't know what it is, but you're right, something's off, that's for sure.
All the Johnnies he knocks back have probably stewed his brain, I said. Looks like he's added gambling to his list of extracurricular activities now. Wolfie exhaled loudly.
Let's just keep this whole sunlight business between us from now on, okay?
Copy that. It was fine by me. Trust isn't exactly my middle name. Which is possibly why I found it so hard to sleep that night. Between Bodie Calder, Watkiss, and the Primrose Hill Killer, I had a few things on my mind. 2 days earlier, Thursday. Chapter 34. Scotland Yard, 08:45. By the time I arrived at the yard the next morning, I'd already had 5 texts through on my phone from Bodie Calder.
Don't forget to bring the flash drive in.
SMS 0710.
Remember the flash drive.
SMS 0730.
Did you get my messages about the flash drive?
SMS 0743.
Important. I'll need the flash drive ASAP.
SMS 0830.
Have you been getting my texts?
SMS 0840. He was persistent, I had to give him that. Though where had this sense of urgency been over the last 2 years? Not focused on solving Duncan's homicide, that's for sure. I decided to ignore the messages I didn't want to deal with. In other words, all of them.
Morning, everyone,
said Isaacson, perching on the end of a table at the front of the briefing room. The trenches beneath his eyes were deeper than yesterday. His mouth was drooping, but his shirt was clean and pressed, and he'd gargled with Listerine. Whatever was going on in his personal life, he was doing his best to keep a lid on it.
We've got the PM report back on Lily Abion, he said. You'll find it in your inboxes. But the top line's this. COD has been confirmed as asphyxiation and exsanguination, just like Pejman. And there were 38 stab wounds in all, first one being to the back of the neck, also like Pejman.
They're obliteration attacks, I said. The overkill shows the offender wants to literally wipe out his victims. The primary motive here is power.
Are you sure? The signature seems pretty sexual to me,
said the bald guy I'd been sitting next to yesterday. That's about causing maximum humiliation. This killer's pleasure is all about dominating his victims. Isaacson unscrewed a half-empty Gaviscon bottle and took a swig.
I hate the weird ones, he said.
It didn't surprise me. The DI was obviously a man who liked order and predictability, but that didn't mean I agreed with him. Unusual details always offer a clue. As Sherlock Holmes, the godfather of profiling, said, the more unexceptional a crime, the harder it is to solve. Uniqueness paints a picture.
Have we got anything back on the footwear marks found at the scene?
Said Big Daddy, leaning back in his chair, a smudge of jam on his shirt collar. My adrenaline kicked in, even though I'd already guessed the answer. Despite the UK's massive database, marks aren't the same as DNA. Without a glass slipper, they rarely lead to a princess. Isaacson shook his head.
Judging by the partials, forensics reckons we're looking at a size 4 New Balance trainer, which suggests someone between 5 foot and 5 foot 5. So, given what we heard about the offender's height yesterday, they're likely to have been left by our killer. Both the ones around the body and the ones looking in on the crime scene from further away.
He paused.
I don't want to worry you, but I wouldn't be doing my job properly if I didn't say this. Just because you're police doesn't mean you're immune to being a target. Watch your backs, people. And if you're concerned about anything, come straight to me.
More or less, word for word, what Jack had said to me last night. Chapter 35.
Mackenzie, I'd like you to take the lead at the press conference this morning,
said Isaacson, after he had handed out the day's jobs, which included probing Axel Montand's alibi, getting a warrant to search his car, and checking out Dan Harper's story about Lily Abion chatting to a possibly bearded bloke in the bar. I'm happy to talk about the profile, but you or the DCI should really take the lead.
Falcon's been called away to Hampshire, and I have complete faith in you, he said with a dead-eyed smile.
Bollocks you do, I thought. You just don't want to face the pack.
He doesn't like our sort, Jack had said last night, and my foray on Google after he'd left had shown why.
Isaacson had transferred to Scotland Yard from the Surrey Force, where he'd made a name for himself during his work on the murder of schoolgirl Sally Rhodes back in 2007. However, that's not what he'd have remembered most about the case. Cops up and down the country were still spitting bile about the media's carryings on during the investigation. To begin with, the press worked well with the police, leading the call for witnesses. But after the first few days, as public interest grew, it all changed. The press became ruthless, and with fewer restraints and more resources than the major incident team, they began to churn up ground they should never have stepped foot on. One of the tabloids went as far as hacking phones to get an inside edge, and even deleted the missing girl's voicemails during the early days of the search to clear space for more messages. It was completely illegal, never mind unethical, and massively hampered the police investigation. But worse than that, it gave Sally's family false hope she was still alive. No wonder, then, that D.I. Isaacson wasn't a fan of the press. But the way I saw it, he needed to suck up his feelings and get on with his job. Journos may be a bunch of unscrupulous go-fasters, but to nail the Primrose Hill killer, we'd need their help, whether we liked it or not. I pushed harder, but it was no use. The D.I. wasn't budging. As my father would have said, you need to know when you're barking at the wrong dog. He never did get the hang of English idioms. Anything I should know before I go in there? I said, the equivalent of waving a white flag. The Iranian element's bound to come up. I'm already getting it in the neck from community groups mouthing off about hate crimes. He rubbed at the knuckle of his index finger with his thumb. I got where he was coming from. The Met doesn't exactly sport a halo when it comes to racism, despite the top brass's best efforts to knock the unit into shape. Heavier penalties for racially motivated crimes, changes in investigation priorities, diversity recruitment targets. The UK has the biggest arsenal of anti-discrimination powers in Western Europe, not that it's seen that way. Race only becomes an issue if we accept it's a motivator here, and I don't think it is, I said.
Victimology would suggest you're wrong,
piped up the lovely Ruddock, putting in his 2 pennies worth. No, victimology would suggest we're looking at a preferential offender, someone who's killing surrogates because he hasn't built up the confidence to go after the woman he truly hates. That's not the same thing at all. Isaacson raised an eyebrow, the faintest shadow of a smile on his lips. First time for everything, I thought. Race hate crimes typically spike after inflammatory incidents like the murder of that British soldier by Islamic extremists a while ago, I said. Daily Mail readers may not like our immigration policy, but nothing's happened recently to fan things.
Like I said, I have complete faith in you to take the lead on this.
Isaacson gave one of his curt nods.
Just give me a heads up on what you plan to say before you go in there.
So much for complete faith. Chapter 36. Press Room, Scotland Yard, 10:30. I took my place on the podium and surveyed the packed press room. Correspondents from every paper and news channel were jammed in balls to nutsack. Jack would be in amongst the throng, but I'd need X-ray vision to see him, despite his height. The microphone squealed as I turned it on, and the room at once became quiet. Now the killer had turned serial, if possible, media interest had doubled. Though it wasn't just the public I'd be addressing today. Serial killers love attention. They follow the news closely. This offender would be no different. He'd be listening to me talk, no doubt about it. The volume on his telly turned up high, set to record, so he could watch me speak again and again until he knew the words by heart. Good morning. I'd like to begin by thanking you for your cooperation during this investigation. We value your appeals to witnesses, and moving forward, we anticipate that they will generate important leads, I said, going into schmooze overdrive. Although the cop-press relationship is to some degree symbiotic, it's still important to get the media on side. Hence the ass-kissing. I summarised the attacks and confirmed Lily Abian's killer was the same person responsible for the murder of Yasmin Pejman. And now I'd like to share with you aspects of the profile we've developed, which we'd appreciate you passing on to your readers and viewers. This was the key bit. The hope was that someone would recognise the person I described and come forward.
I went through the profile I'd outlined to the murder team, point by point. There's been a stressor in the offender's life, I said finally, beginning to wrap up. The death of a loved one, the breakdown of a relationship, or the loss of a job, for example. He's been coping until now, but a recent traumatic event has brought his negative feelings to the fore, and they're causing him to lash out. Behaviorally, he will exhibit mood changes. Immediately after each attack, he will have been exhausted and acting irrationally. This may give way to jumpiness, anger, and/or depressive feelings, which he may try to manage with drugs or alcohol. So far, he's been content to attack stand-ins for the source of his rage, but it's only a matter of time before he goes after the real thing. We're looking for witnesses who may have seen the victims getting into a car or talking to a man who fits the profile on the nights they disappeared. And we're also appealing to anyone who thinks they might recognise the offender from the description I've just given to come forward. The offender probably has a wife or a girlfriend, and she will have noticed something's not quite right. A change in his behaviour, an overly keen interest in the case, possibly even blood on his clothes. It's very important that she comes forward, not least because she may herself be in danger. Serial killers build up gradually to what we call the main event. But the warning signs will already be there. Erratic behaviour, aggression, strange requests. And now I'd like to open the floor to questions. There were a number relating to the issue of race and leads, and then a hack I recognised from outside Tristan Fontaine's house yesterday pushed herself forward.
Tanya Spira, The Mirror. With respect, Ms. Mackenzie, how's this profiling thing any more accurate than my Cosmo horoscope?
There were a few titters around the room. Spira looked pleased with herself. I gave her the once-over before answering. She was standing at the front, and I'm long-sighted. Easy pickings. Your tailored black trouser suit, pearl earrings and Prada handbag are in conflict with your bleached to breaking point hair and East End accent. You grew up on a council estate and swore one day you'd turn your life around. It's why you're so ambitious. You feel the need to prove yourself, and you don't let anything stand in your way. But in the process, you've lost any empathy you might have once had. Grieving relatives, victims of tragedy, they're all commodities for you, a route to getting what you want. And when you come home at night and eat your microwave tandoori at the kitchen counter, you only have your cats for company, one tabby, the other ginger. There were a few laughs, and some awkward shuffling.
How did you know I had a curry last night?
Said Spira, looking part stunned, part embarrassed.
And about my cats?
It's that profiling thing, plus there's a sauce stain on your shirt and animal hair on your jacket. The room broke out into spontaneous applause. It was a nice moment. And the killer would have watched it unfold.
Chapter 37. Vice Department, Scotland Yard, 11:38.
As soon as the press conference was out of the way, I nipped up to the 10th floor to get a visual on Gavin Handler. Guilt was a drill sergeant loud in my ear. Get the dog on, Mackenzie. You should have answers by now. It was nearly midday. A whole morning had swung by without me doing anything about the flash drive. It seemed disloyal, like I wasn't giving Duncan's homicide the attention he deserved. And if I didn't get to the bottom of all this, who would? Not Calder, that's for damn sure. My mobile vibrated in my pocket. Talk of the devil, I thought, bouncing the call. Interesting. He can unplug his finger when it matters to him. The door to the vice room was open. I slipped in and hovered by the wall, trying to look as inconspicuous as possible. Know your mark, my SF instructor used to say. Don't go near your tango till you know what they like for breakfast and how often they shit. In the field, that would have involved weeks of careful recon. But I didn't have weeks. I didn't even have minutes. By my estimation, I'd be lucky if I got 30 seconds to get a read before someone asked me what I was doing there. Still, you can find out a lot about a person in 30 seconds,
if you know what to look for.
I'd assess Handler from a distance, then approach him later when he was on his own. I figured with my skill set it should be easy enough to find out where he lived and run into him down his local. He was sitting at a desk by the window, recognisable from the mugshot I'd found on the system yesterday. And he was writing. Every so often he checked a sheet of paper next to him and made amendments. Meticulous, I thought. And nervous, too. He was chewing his bottom lip, continually glancing over at the person sitting at the desk next to his. Kurt Watkiss. And unless I'd got it wrong, old Caterpillar Eyebrows was the reason for his edginess. But was he also the cause of Handler's high stress levels? The open Zantac packet, the acne breakout on his forehead, the way he was rubbing the back of his neck. They all told the same story. Gavin Handler was wound up. Though he was also a man in love. The photo on his desk said it all. It was a picture of him and a pretty redhead on a beach, licking 99s and smiling at each other like they'd just been given good cookies.
"Can I help you?" said a man coming over.
I registered it then. They were all men. I was the only female in the room. Bit odd, I thought, given so much of Vice's work focuses on women and children. "No, I was just looking for someone," I said, all nonchalant. If only Handler hadn't gone and looked up just then, I might have slipped away and bumped into him on his home turf, but that was out now, which left me with one play. "Gavin," I said, going over to his desk, "I'm Zeba McKenzie. You worked with my husband, Duncan. He spoke highly of you. I'm doing a job for DCI Falcon. Thought I'd pop up and say hello while I'm here." He and Dunk may never have set foot in a briefing room together, but it was a reasonable bet their paths had crossed. Duncan was in Vice when he was killed, and from what I'd found on the internal system, Handler had been based in the department for the last 3 years. Kurt Watkiss jerked his head up at the mention of Duncan's name, a mottled flush spreading up his neck.
"What makes you think Handler knew your husband?" he said in a squeezed nasal voice, fingering the box of Rothmans by his keyboard. His tone was suspicious, like he knew I was blagging. But how? Of course I could just be being paranoid. It wouldn't be the first time.
"He spoke about him," I said in a dismissive voice, wishing the guy was somewhere else. Having Watkiss listening in wasn't ideal. If only I hadn't had to rush the encounter, I could have planned it better, gone somewhere we wouldn't be disturbed. "I realise you're busy now," I said, turning back to Handler with a smile. "But perhaps I could buy you a drink later. It's possible Duncan's death had something to do with a case he was investigating. I was hoping I could pick your brains. I miss him terribly. Not knowing why he was killed isn't going to bring him back, but it might give me some closure." I chose my words carefully to fit my read of him. I bricked the shot all the same.
"I'm sorry for your loss. I didn't know Duncan, though."
But he wasn't looking at me when he spoke. Instead, his eyes were fixed on Kurt Watkiss. Chapter 38. My approach to Handler hadn't gone well, but I left him my card all the same. Maybe he'll get in touch, I thought, though I wasn't holding my breath. I called the lift. A moment later, Kurt Watkiss was standing behind me, breathing hard, a smoker's wheeze.
"I saw you with Ruddock yesterday. I knew you looked familiar."
"Aye, I was trying to place you too," I said, bluffing.
"Handler definitely didn't know your husband. Duncan and I were on the same team for a bit, though. Feel free to ask me anything you want. But I can assure you his death had nothing to do with anything he was working on. Fiscal impropriety doesn't usually get our boys shot."
"Fiscal impropriety? Bullcrap. Duncan couldn't even get the hang of autosum." The lift hissed open.
"I'll ride with you," Watkiss
said, holding the door open with his forearm and following me in.
I heard his homicide had something to do with a gang shooting. An initiation, they say.
Has he been talking to Calder? I thought, as the doors snapped shut. It had nothing to do with gangs. I gave him a hard look. His murder was an execution, clean and professional. Someone put a hit on him. Watkiss's eyes narrowed. He took a half step towards me.
Strange you remember your husband talking about Handler when he swears he never met him. Perhaps you came across his name somewhere instead, an old file, perhaps?
How the fuck did he know that? Maybe he's just forgotten. It was 2 years ago.
Maybe. But if you do have any of Duncan's old files, you need to hand them in,
he said, his eyes not leaving my face.
You could get into trouble hanging on to them.
He smiled, not so sweetly. His canines were yellow. His breath smelled of fags and bacon. I'm aware of my obligations.
I'm sure you are.
He took a step back and smiled again, temporarily smoothing out the barcode lines around his mouth.
You've been freelancing here for a while, haven't you? Working for Falcon, right? He and I go back donkey's years.
The insinuation was subtle, but clear all the same. I know all about you. I can make life difficult if you cross me. But how did he know so much? Not just about me, but the flash drive too, because the reference to old files couldn't have been a coincidence. Had Calder said something? Though why would he have done? They were in different departments.
You're profiling the gynecologist, aren't you?
Watkiss said, his expression predatory. The gynecologist. Same thing Calder had nicknamed the perp.
They look like you, the victims. Have you noticed that?
He continued as the doors opened.
You must be the killer's type.
It was the second threat he'd made in a 2 minute conversation. Chapter 39. The darkness is back. My husband has changed again. The man who was showering me with love and kisses just days ago is gone. Now Mr. Hyde's in the house. Only he's different to how he was before. Sneakier somehow, like he's waiting to strike when I'm least expecting it. He's hidden the car keys and keeps me locked in the house, so I'm a prisoner, while he runs around with her. I saw the photo. I know what he's been getting up to. I don't understand. Things were going so well. What did I do? I've started having nightmares. Always the same thing. I'm in an alleyway, penned in with nowhere to run. There's a monster with two heads coming towards me, a knife in its claws, its fangs dripping gore with the thick, smooth texture of oil paint. I try to back away, but it's no use. He gets to me, hand over my mouth, pushing me against the wall. The next thing I know, I have the knife in my hand, but I'm not fighting back. Instead, I'm stabbing myself over and over until I'm slippery with my own blood, and all the while the monster's egging me on. Get rid of the bad, it says, its voice high-pitched. You don't deserve to live. You brought this on yourself. And I stab and stab at my flesh, though there's no pain. I feel the frustration build. I thrust the blade in harder. I want to hurt. I want to feel the pain. I want to see it so I can get it out. I start to cry. As the monster leans in close, I see it's my husband. And the blood on his teeth is mine.
Chapter 40. Major Incident Room, Scotland Yard, 1240.
Put your Big Macs down and gather round, people. I've got some news to share.
Isaacson clapped his hands to get everyone's attention.
Tex, come up trumps,
he said, standing in the centre of the makeshift horseshoe.
They've managed to pull some deleted texts off Yasmin Pejman's phone. Looks like she was having an affair.
I thought back to the photos I'd seen of Yasmin Pejman at her house the day before, how physically mismatched she and her husband were, and how she looked like a woman who liked attention.
Tristan Fontaine had said the two of them didn't have secrets, but his non-verbals had told me the opposite was true. Did he know Yasmin had been smashing pisses with someone else? And had he done something about it? He certainly had a possessive streak, but if so, where did Lily Abian fit in? My phone buzzed in my pocket. Calder, again. He was really getting his knickers in a twist about this flash drive. What did he know that he wasn't telling me?
Any idea who Pejman's fancy man is? Said Ruddock, taking a swig of Red Bull.
Isaacson shook his head.
The messages were sent to a burner.
There's only one reason I can think of for him having a burner, I said. The guy must be married. Why else would he need to cover his tracks? Our resident Pretty Ricky, a Zac Efron lookalike, nodded in a first-hand experience sort of way. Tristan Fontaine said Yasmin and her sister were close, I said. Maybe she could light up the picture for us. I'll go and talk to her. Isaacson nodded, pressing his lips together.
Good idea. Take Roderick with you.
Not what I'd intended. With respect, sir, I might get more out of her woman to woman.
Fine. Take Frost.
I meant going on my own.
That's against protocol, Mackenzie. You said woman to woman. Frost fits the bill. She's even wearing a skirt today.
Could have fooled me,
said Ruddock in a stage whisper, which got him a playful slap on the arm from Frost and a laugh from the rest of the crew, apart from the DI, of course, whose face, as usual, didn't twitch.
All right, people, settle down. I'll let you have a look at Pejman's messages and then you can all get back to the grindstone, he said,
hitting a key on his laptop and bringing a set of racy texts up on the whiteboard. I get wet just thinking about you. I need you inside me. Lying in bed, wish you were next to me playing Simon Says. I love the feeling of your hard cock in my mouth. You're such a man, not like my limp dick husband. Limp dick, I thought, zeroing in on the last message. It could just be derogatory, or it could mean Tristan Fontaine is impotent. Just like the offender.
Chapter 41. Archives Room, Scotland Yard, 1347. What Kiss's comment about Duncan's old files had got me thinking. The flash drive was all well and good, but the only thing it really told me was that Duncan had been looking into an operation called Sunlight and the names of some of the people linked to it. In other words, sweet Fanny Adams. But if I could get my hands on his work files from the days leading up to his homicide, I'd be able to get a better idea what it was all about. Anything he'd stored on his computer would have been wiped or transferred long ago, but NSY's old school. Despite their multi-million pound computer databases, they also keep paper records. I'd arranged to meet Yasmin Pejman's sister at 3. That gave me time to swing by the archives room first, cramming in the minutes again. I nipped into the Starbucks across the road to pick up an offering, then took the lift down to the vaults where all the old files are kept. I'd spent plenty of time down here after Duncan was killed, searching for answers. I hadn't known where to start, though, and despite all the help Rita on the front desk had given me, I'd come up empty. But now I knew what I was looking for. Anything referencing Sunlight or the players listed on the stick.
Zeba! Said Rita with a big smile as I came over. Ooh, is that for me?
She reached out for the coffee and brownie I'd brought her.
Bless you, what a treat.
She pushed her glasses up on her head and took a sip.
Mmm, lovely, just what I needed. So, how are you doing, pet?
She did the whole head tilt thing. She was talking about life post-Duncan rather than the general state of my health. Suited me. She'd be more helpful if she was sympathetic. Coffee and cake only gets you so far. It's been 2 years already. Can you believe it? She shook her head.
He was a lovely man, your husband. Always so polite. Not like some of them.
And there's you,
So young still and so pretty. I hate to think of you by yourself.
Perfect lead-in.
I'm starting to think the only way I'll ever be able to get closure is if I find out who killed Duncan. I can understand that. Lordy, it was too terrible what happened to him.
You know, I think his murder could have something to do with the job.
Really?
She said, brows springing up. Aye, it's starting to look that way. Something to do with whatever he was working on. I thought I might find a clue down here. She looked down, picking at her nails, uncomfortable all of a sudden. But why?
Do you have time to dig out his files from between September and October 2 years ago?
She made a sucking noise. It made a sound like the air going out of a balloon. Definitely uncomfortable.
I have clearance, I said, though she already knew that.
She'd spent hours pulling records for me back when Duncan was shot. She fiddled with her necklace. What wasn't she telling me?
Check with Calder if you need to. I don't mind waiting. Well, that's just the thing, you see.
What do you mean?
He came down last night, said your clearance had been revoked with regards to Duncan's files or anything relating to SCD-9.
Vice.
They've renamed it, stands for Serious Crime Directorate 9, Human Exploitation and Organised Crime Command.
She was waffling, trying to change the subject. I set her firmly back on track.
You said he came down. What time was this? I can tell you exactly, she said, checking the log, pleased to be able to give me something. Here we go. 7:30.
Just after I'd left his office. Less than 5 minutes after I'd spoken to him about sunlight, Bodie Calder was making moves to shut me down.
Chapter 42.
Home of Yasmin Pejman's sister, Kilburn, 1500. Yasmin Pejman's sister, Nagin, lived in a one-bedroom flat in Kilburn that smelled of fag ends and cheesy feet. I sat on the sofa with her while she told me about Yazzy, and D.S. Frost fixed some brews in the kitchen. She'd gone in, all chattity-chat, insisting Nagin put her feet up and let her sort out the tea. I knew what she was doing, softening up the victim's sister, making a human connection and everything. But if I'd been Nagin, I'd have booted her out on her backside. I'd have much preferred to interview the sister on my own. I reckoned she'd talk a lot more freely without a copper present. And the cache of Rizzler papers and the cannabis grinder I'd spotted behind a plant pot did nothing to shake that.
Here we go, said Frost, coming back in carrying 3 mugs on a tray, smiling broadly.
She pulled a wooden chair over from the table and sat down opposite us.
Now you've had some time to absorb what happened to Yasmin, we wanted to come and talk to you, see if you could tell us a bit about her, she said, blowing the steam off her tea.
Everyone loved her, said Nagin, wiping her eyes. She was good fun, you know. Had a wicked sense of humour, but a heart of gold too. Made friends wherever she went.
If I had a quid for every cliché in there, I could pick up a nice bottle of Rioja on the way home, I thought. That's the problem with relatives. It's impossible to get a true impression of a victim from the people that loved them. They're always too busy building their pedestals. Luckily, I wasn't interested in getting a picture of Yasmin Pejman, though. I was more interested in confirming that she and her sister were as tight as Fontaine had claimed, and finding out what she knew about the bloke she was screwing. Although the image she painted of Yasmin was about as unoriginal as a squaddy keeping his digs clean, Nagin's non-verbals left no doubt about their closeness.
We were besties, she said. We told each other everything.
Perfect. We've managed to pull some sects off Yasmin's phone, I said. Frost gave me a look. She'd probably have preferred it if I'd said something naff like, texts of a personal nature. I took a more direct approach. If I was coy with Nagin, she'd be coy with me, and that was the last thing I wanted. Sounds like she was having an affair, I said. Any idea who she was seeing? Nagin dropped her eyes and shook her head.